Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, where we talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Tonight, I'm speaking with two jazz greats. First, veteran singer and pianist Freddie Cole, and later this hour, jazz and classical trumpeter, composer, and artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center, Wynton Marsalis. Freddie Cole has been recording jazz for over 50 years. Often referred to as Nat King Cole's brother, Freddie Cole has long established his career as a jazz performer and entertained audiences across the globe. I spoke with Freddie Cole earlier, just before he headed out on his European tour. I want to talk a little bit about your childhood. What type of household did you grow up in? I know you had three brothers. It was a very musical family, but you were the baby, or were you?
Yes, I am. Okay. I'm the blue-eyed baby boy. Yeah, it was five of us, four boys and one girl. My older brother's name was Eddie Cole. He had a band called Eddie Cole and the Hot Swingers. And Nat used to play piano in his band. And then my sister, Evelyn, very lovable lady, everybody used to call her Bay.
Did she sing too?
No. Okay. She could play piano. She played a little bit at the church, but she was a good piano player. Her daughter, Janice, was a wizard. You know, Janice could really play.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
you had Ike too, your brother Ike?
Ike was 4 years older than me.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, your father's a minister, your mother was the choir director?
Yeah, my father was a minister in Chicago, and my mother was a choir director, and she played piano.
Did you sing in the choir?
Not if I can get away.
So, as a matter of fact, I understand that when people like, Duke Ellington or Mr. B or something came by the house, it really was no big thing to you. You'd rather play ball, right?
Yes, exactly right.
Well, you were the first, though, in your family, I understand, to attend college.
Yeah. I was.
So how in the world did you get into Juilliard? Not how in the world did you get into Juilliard, no offense, but back in 1950s, I would think that there weren't a whole lot of African Americans.
No, there weren't a lot. You know, there was quite a few, but
oh, really?
You know, in different departments. Most of us were in music ed. You know, and
was it difficult in terms of the socialization?
No, not so much. So, okay.
What about the New England Conservatory of Music?
That's where I ended up. My brother had to get me out of New York.
Oh.
When you call me, he called me America's guest. So I left New England. Actually, I was in Juilliard and I got the gig with Earl Bostick's band. And, you know, I left school, went out on the road, you know, for a minute and ended up in Boston. So I went to, got in New England Conservatory. Mm-hmm. And it was good. It was a good move. And they shocked me year before last. They gave me a doctorate.
Oh, wonderful.
Honorary doctorate.
Wonderful.
It was all worthwhile.
So tell me about those early years of jazz. I know that, even before you got out there, back in the day when Mr. B was singing, and from what I understand, in the early years of jazz, that black vocalists weren't even really able to sing romantic ballads to the audience directly. Do you know anything about that?
I heard talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Mr. B was the first one to break through with that. He and Billy Daniels.
Mr. B, of course, meaning Billy Eckstein.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The wonderful one.
Yes.
But Billy Daniels was a very fine singer, too. He broke through.
They broke some barriers.
Yeah. You know, his biggest thing was, you know, the old black magic, you know.
Oh, yeah. Jazz from the 60s to 90s, I was looking at it, and it's so eclectic. It has so many influences now. The influx of Latin, Afro-Cuban, funk, so forth, and many, many more. What were you focusing on during the 60s and the 70s?
Playing music.
Just
You know, I came along before they had the time of everything had to have a title. You know, what kind of music do you play? I play black and white keys, that's what I play.
I play good music.
Yeah, you know. And that was when, you know, the media got in the middle of it and took it here.
Mm.
But what got me one time, I was doing an interview with a guy. He said, well, what do you think about this urban contemporary adult music? I said, what is that?
Me too.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Labels that get you in trouble, don't they?
Yeah, everything has to be labeled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they still do it, you know, but if you let that hold you back, then you're trouble.
Did you have to struggle to find your niche?
Yeah, I'm still struggling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, you know, life is a struggle. You know, if you don't struggle for it, you know, if you ain't put some pay some dues and take some lumps, you haven't done anything. That's my way of looking at it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like to rake and scrape, as the guys say.
Put you
right in the middle of what is happening musically and around the guys. You know, it's a good feeling.
What did you call that, rake and what?
Rake and scrape.
What is
scrape? raking and scraping.
Oh, okay.
Trying to get over, you right. know. And I tell a lot of them, you know, singers and musicians and all that talk to me, whatever. And they stay in the bed till 11, 12, 1 or 2 o'clock in the day.
Oh.
I say, I don't know nobody that works that stay in the bed that long, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the business is done in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
Nightclub is open at night, but the business is done in the daytime. So you got to learn the business, period, you know.
In terms of how you need to behave in it
to
be successful.
Right, how you find your place.
Yeah. Now, you maintained your popularity, you know, throughout the 60s, the 70s, and so forth, and spent your time playing in Europe. But then around the 90s, mid-90s or something, you kind of, like, your popularity kind of took off again.
Well, I've been around long enough.
Well, you say, thank God, it's about time.
Yeah, I started going over to Japan, over the Far East and all, you know. And I had some success record-wise over there and in Brazil, in South America. And, that kind of did it, you know.
So what was it about Brazil? I know you do like those Brazilian ballads. What did you learn from them, you said?
Oh, it's so much. It's a pleasure to watch him. My friend Perry Biro, he was a very, very wonderful singer. And Roberto Carlos, Vando, all these cats, they were good musicians and singers. And they made great records.
What do you
and
think
they
made
were teaching me the language and what to do and how to hang out over there. It was beautiful.
Was there anything in particular with respect to their style that you liked?
Yeah, most of them, even though you could not understand the music, you could feel them. And they had a beautiful feeling, and they made you think as if they're singing directly to you.
That's one of the things that other musicians compliment you about, and that's your ability to literally reach through the song and touch people, you know, with the story.
Yeah, well, I learned that from them. I know my father used to preach a sermon one time about reach out and touch someone.
Right.
You know, the gospel's supposed to reach out and touch you, you know. So if you can be playing to an audience like we had last week of 10,000 or more people, then if you touch one in there, you did your job.
Really? I'm talking with Freddie Cole, great jazz pianist and vocalist, Grammy nominated on several occasions, three or four at least, I believe. So I'm delighted to be joined with him today. Before we actually started this conversation outside, we had talked a little bit about the health of jazz, and I asked you about the rumors and the articles and the stories about jazz being dead. So what's your take on that?
I think that they're being misled. That's a good word. They're misled. They don't understand what's happening. Jazz is not dead, and jazz will always be. All you have to do is go into any of your high schools now, and with a lot of young people with social clubs and neighborhood things, what's the first thing they want to do? Play an instrument. And they have jazz musicians now teaching in schools. You know, that's another myth they put down, that you had to have a degree to teach. And you've got this world of experience of going all over the world, working with people and doing this. Why couldn't you teach a child about some music? You have to have a degree? No. You know, but music, it transcends all of that. You know, I mean, I use an expression, I keep hope alive, I keep jazz alive.
Well, the problem, or I think maybe part of the problem might be that I'm not sure if people know anymore exactly what jazz is. I know 25, 30 years ago, people said, what kind of music do you like? I say, I like jazz. And they say, well, what kind of jazz? Today, now they want to know today, what kind of jazz? And I'm good jazz. You know? It's like, I don't know about all these, the specialization. Do you think, all of this infusion into the jazz, like I mentioned earlier, funk jazz, acid jazz, free jazz, so forth, do you think this specialization helps or hurts the genre?
Well, I'll tell you, like Dr. Billy Taylor, who's one of my favorite persons, and just died a year or so ago, he says, jazz has nothing to be ashamed of. We performed before kings and queens all over the world before this other music came through. He says, now I'm not knocking the other music, but I'm proud to be a jazz musician. It seems that they changed so much because they all want to be in those shoes.
Aha. Uh-huh. So do you consider yourself a purist?
No. I just play the music.
Okay.
Just plain Freddy. I had a CD called that.
What advice do you give young musicians today?
Try to learn the business.
Okay.
That's
as important as the music itself.
Learn the business, and once you do that, try to learn how to present what you do.
Now, what do you mean, present what you do?
You can be a great player. You can be an excellent musician. But if you don't know how to express yourself or express what is happening, it goes over the people's head.
Right, right. I've listened at the very first albums that you did, and your most recent, which is This and That, mm-hmm. which I really love. And I can see your evolution throughout the years, as it should be, So you've been inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame in 2007, deservingly so. 2010, you saw a Grammy nomination for your album Freddie Cole Sings Mr. B, meaning, of course, Billy Eckstine. So it's no wonder that one of your trademarks is that you can be called upon to do just about any kind of song, but always in the way that you want to do it.
Because
you don't do songs you don't like to do.
Yeah, exactly. If I don't like a song,
even if they ask
I don't
you.
Care how good the song is, if I don't like it, I don't do it.
What's your history in Atlanta? I mean, you live here now, but you used to perform back at the Royal Peacock. Remember those days?
Yes, I do. The first time I played there, we were on the bill with Gladys Knight. That was the second time. First time I played it, we were on a show with Ruth Brown.
So you were about how old then, roughly?
30s? I don't remember growing old.
I was just wondering that Gladys Knight must have been really young.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, okay. Are there any particular songwriters that you feel most closely resemble your soul, so to say, in their writing and arrangements of music?
I've always been a lover of Ellington and Cole Porter and Jerome Kern, and I could go on and on. You know, I just did a show a couple of weeks ago, and we were in Newark at the Performing Arts Center, you know, and did a Harold Arlen show. And, you know, I've done several things like that. Mm-hmm. So I know so many people that write songs. This is how I get a lot of songs.
Yeah,
and I'm not afraid to try them. But it has to touch me some kind of way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Finding your voice takes a long time, too.
Will and won't do. You got to learn that.
Mm-hmm. And it takes years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's probably why you're so good, sir, because you've had so many years.
Some of us never learn.
I'm going to read you a couple of my favorite songs of yours. And I'd like for you to tell me maybe what the history is behind them. Nothing Wrong with Nothing. I love that.
Nothing's wrong with nothing since you came my way. Everything's okay with me. That's my man Timmy Rogers. He was a great comedian. And Timmy used to work with Nat quite often, and Nat would put together his shows and all that. And that's where I say the expression came, oh yeah!
Oh.
You know, and Timmy wrote another song called It's Crazy, But I'm in Love.
Oh, I like that one too.
Yeah. But Nothing's Wrong with Nothing. I was over at Timmy's house one time. He lived up in Harlem. Up 155th Street, up that way. And they were in the house, and his wife was cooking or something. We went there, you know, and an expression came up. Nothing's wrong with nothing. Well, Timmy wrote the song.
It was great.
And I'm the only one that's ever recorded it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when I do it now, I think about my granddaughter. Well, I call her Miss Muffin, you know. Yeah, Christina, yeah, Miss Muffin.
Now, you also did something on your latest album, This and That, Everybody's Talking. That's from Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah,
How did that get in there?
Yeah. Everybody's talking at me, but I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and staring, but I don't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I always liked that tune. I recorded it once before in Europe on Decca Records out of London, and it was a big hit for me over in South Africa. This was before they broke up the apartheid.
Oh.
Yeah, I had a chance to go, but I wouldn't.
In 1987, the U.S. House and Senate passed a resolution to define jazz as a unique form of American music, stating that, quote, jazz is hereby designated as a rare and valuable national American treasure to which we should devote our attention, support, and resources to make certain it is preserved, understood, and promulgated. Sir, you are a vital part of that American treasure. I thank you so much for being a part of the jazz scene, for being here with us today. And all I can say is keep on playing and singing, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in conversation with jazz and classical trumpeter, composer, educator, and artistic director for jazz at Lincoln Center, Wynton Marsalis.
Mm-hmm.
This is Valerie Jackson, and you're listening to In Conversation. My next guest, Wynton Marsalis, is a member of the famed Marsalis family of New Orleans. Often called the first family of jazz, father Ellis Marsalis, jazz pianist and music educator, was inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame in 2008 and set the course for music, with four of his six sons following in his footsteps. Wynton, the second son, is probably best known among them. He began performing with New Orleans jazz bands at the age of eight. By 14, he was performing with the New Orleans Philharmonic. Who would have known he'd go on to win 9 Grammy Awards in both jazz and classical music? He's written 5 books and was the first jazz musician to win a Pulitzer Prize for music for his epic oratorio, Blood on the Fields. He has expanded the definition of jazz and is placed among the world's finest musicians and composers. This Friday, Wynton and his Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra will perform at Atlanta Symphony Hall as part of the National Black Arts Festival with a program called Modern Life, Modern Jazz. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Wynton. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us today.
It's my honor and pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you know, you'll be performing here in Atlanta at Symphony Hall with Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra as part of the National Black Arts Festival. Is there going to be a special theme for that concert?
Yeah, we're going to be playing a lot of our modern music and music of members of our orchestra. A lot of times we come to Atlanta, we play at the Symphony Hall. It's like coming home because we have a lot of members who are based from Georgia who are based in Atlanta. And it's always festive and soulful. We always have a great group crowd of people who want to come and check it out, and the band is always excited.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because we love you, and we appreciate that, too. Appreciate your work.
Tell us about it.
And we will when I see you. I'll make sure everybody does. I want to touch back just a little briefly to your childhood. You're part of a truly remarkable family of outstanding musicians and artists. Your father, Ellis, is the patriarch of the clan, and he's played and taught jazz for 60, 70 years maybe. What type of father was he growing up? Was he stern, easy? What kind of father was he?
He's very easy. He's very humble. We're struggling because, you know, jazz musician trying to play real jazz, they couldn't make money. And I learned more watching him and going to so many gigs with him. It'd be 5 and 6 people in the club, 10 people, people talking over him when he was playing. He always played with integrity, and he was always, he was just watching him, I understood the music was something special. And of course, as a youngster, I didn't like the music. I liked what was on the radio. When I got into high school, my brother and I played in the funk band, and we had many more people and could even make more money than him night to night, as great as a musician as he was. But he never gave up. And also, he didn't put pressure on us, like, you got to do this. And it wasn't like we felt like we had a musical legacy and all of that. We knew about him, and we respected his sacrifice. He was not a person who was given a lot of personal touchy-feely type. Never heard him complain, never heard him whine. He believed you should be mature. We started working when we were young. I always had a job since I was 8. He always encouraged you to work. And the main thing I learned from him is that my father was the least judgmental and prejudiced person I ever met. And this was in the late 60s, 70s, coming out of the civil rights movement, a lot of strife between black and white folks. You know, we all had our afros and we was black power and all of that. I could see my daddy many times in just all black environment going against any kind of thing that was racist or anything that had something to do about anti-white people. So he had great deal of conviction. Now, he wasn't a handkerchief head. It wasn't like he was tarming, but he just didn't believe in any judgment. He hated for you to talk, lump people into a group. So if you would say they all, or he would say, man, who is they all? Right. And then he would say, all of everybody never does anything. And so I learned like the kind of philosophy of the jazz musicians from watching him and the other cats and the type of depth of intellect and soul that they had.
Well, who introduced, or rather who influenced your father? What music or whose music did he listen to?
Well, he loved Charlie Parker. He loved Duke. He loved Thelonious Monk. He loved Bill Evans. He loved Miles Davis. He named me after Miles Davis' piano player, Wynton Kelly.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, he was very much like a modern jazz jazz man, and he loved the cats. He loved Sonny Rollins. He loved Cole. He loved Coltrane. Train came to our house one time. So he just loved Train. He loved McCoy, you know, in the early 60s. I was born in 61. Train and him came to New Orleans in 62. So there's a photo we always had of my daddy and a great New Orleans drummer, James Black, standing with Coltrane. And it was like a shrine. It's like a something in a shrine. You know, yeah, man, that's when Train and them was in New Orleans playing their Vernons.
Was it true that you got your first trumpet from Al Hurt?
Yes, ma'am, I did. Wow. When I was 6 years old. But I mean, I didn't want to play trumpet, but I had it. I didn't want to get that ring around my lips because I felt like New Orleans trumpet players all had ugly lips, and I think the girls wasn't going to like me. So I was like, man, I'm not practicing that because I don't want that lip.
But if you could go back in time in history, who would you want to play with and talk with?
I think if in jazz, I feel like I would want to play with... If I could pick anything, I want to play with Basie's band in the 30s. One of my great mentors is Sweets Edison. Mm-hmm. I met him in New Orleans when I was in high school, and he played in that great Basie band that left out of Kansas City after the Depression, 37, 38. And I just like the soul that they play with. It's very community feeling, riffs, and just swinging, you know, good stomp down. So I think I would have a good time hanging with them. Whenever I was around them, when they were older men, it was always soulful. So him, Rudy Rutherford, Buddy Tate, you know, all the kind of cats who played in that band at that time. It was just Joe Jones.
Right. By the time you were 8, you were performing in jazz bands and winning classical competitions at 14. So did you have any especially fond memories of those teen years?
No, I mainly worked through my teen years. I played in the funk band. We played a lot, 4 or 5 gigs a week. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of equipment. We played top 40 music, you know, whatever was popular, a lot of Earth, Wind & Fire, a lot of Parliament Funkadelic, some James Brown, Marvin Gaye, that kind of music. I had the opportunity to play with a lot of people, play with the New Orleans Philharmonic, extra trumpet, play with the New Orleans Civic Orchestra. That was a lot of fun. I played with... a band out at the airport in the Sheraton. So I was working all the time. Mm. We had one of the dumbest names ever, Killer Force and the Crispy Critters. We played like, you know, lounge gigs. We played, and I played parades. If there'd be a parade on the weekend, I would go play in a parade. I played, I had the opportunity because I was in New Orleans to play a wide range of music. So I look back on that. But I was also just working all the time. And right. I always had a lot of homework. I went to a really difficult school.
Making excellent grades, I might add.
Yes, so. Ma'am. I did a lot of work, but I would bring my homework to my gig. Sometimes I'd be playing in wild clubs or something that was kind of like the Dream Palace or the Absinthe Bar, something late at night. And I was 15 or 16. I always bring my work with me. Cats would tease me, but I'd go in the back and do my homework in my hour break. And then sometimes I'd get home at 1, 2 in the morning. My mom was always cool about it because, you know, my daddy and that type of lifestyle.
Right.
And
well, what about your mom? I know later on she got involved with the business with your brother Jason, but how was she in those earlier years? Was she involved?
You know, she was, my mama was, you know, my mama could do my chemistry homework when I was in high school, and she could do it fast. she was just overwhelmed. A lot of kids, no money, you know, expectations, like kind of to be that intelligent and that in the type of jobs that was offered her. She's very social conscious. She worked with this thing called Extension, the government program called Extension. She'd come up out of the projects, the St. Bernard projects. And my mom always had that element. Like she could go out in the street and whip somebody's behind. She was for real. And you know, she was a handful, but she made us have a much higher quality of life.
Interesting.
Because we didn't really have that much, but she knew how to stretch. Mm-hmm. George Washington was weighing 500 pounds on the dollar when she finished stretching him out. And she just deeply intelligent, soulful, but very conflicted about just the situation. Was that, you know, we were having a very hard time. A lot of kids, no resources.
And six boys at that.
Yeah, it was a lot. And she didn't want us to be in the street and all that. So she was kind of, she had two brothers that was kind of wild. One of them became addicted to drugs, and he died early. So she didn't really know her father. You know, it's kind of a typical story. Right. We didn't have like a storybook story. Mm-hmm. You know, we were struggling like all the people in our area. People didn't have much money. Black people in the South, they kind of grew up in segregation, and it was more extreme. I always don't like to when it's painted like, you know, we sat around a piano,
right,
playing music and singing jazz. We didn't live like that at all. We mm-hmm. we very much had like a travail and a struggle. Not as bad as many, but not storybook. You know, it was for real.
Well, you played your way through bands and Art Blakey's group and the Messengers and others, and moved on up to New York City, and all of a sudden there's Jazz at Lincoln Center. Or maybe not all of a sudden, but as manager and artistic director of Jazz at Lincoln Center, you've really, really helped to develop that institution into a multidimensional institution, which really spans the globe now by the way of the internet. I mean, where are you not? With that kind of exposure, what do you think is your major responsibility to the institution of jazz now?
Our major responsibility is to be about the integrity of it. That's our responsibility to our culture. It's our responsibility to ourselves. And it's our responsibility to the art form. And it's also our responsibility for us to sanctify each other's work. Like, I don't want my colleagues to work on something that's not worth them working on. Because mm-hmm. when people work in these nonprofit institutions, it's not like they're getting rich doing it. It's very much an institution that's mission-driven, and if we're not going to be about our mission, then we're wasting your time. So our job, especially in this time in our culture, is to be about integrity. Mm-hmm. And we've seen such an erosion of integrity, especially in the black culture, in the black American life, that it's important for those of us who actually have a love and a knowledge and understanding of that culture to have even more integrity, and then to extend out from the ethnic identity, it extends also to American culture, because the two are inextricable. You can identify them by different names because they do exist. There is a black American culture. There is an Anglo-American culture. There are different types of culture, but they're inextricable. So you can identify them, but you make the mistake when you think you can divorce them from one another. They cannot be divorced. They're mutually mm-hmm. They're co-independent, and they were formed alongside each other. It's in our Constitution. It's in all of our earliest arts. It's in our DNA. That's a reality.
Mm. Well, with all of the new technology, has the fabric of jazz changed?
No, technology can't change the fabric of an art form.
Okay.
Like the fact that Beethoven wrote for a piano didn't change the fabric of the art. It's now what he would write is played on the piano. At a certain point, he got to the point where he said, I'm only writing for strings or for the human voice. And Bach, its technology changed. He was writing music. He didn't even use the keyboards and the things that were available. And I think that, you know, you can add other instruments, you can do different things, but because the technology of the human soul has not changed that much, the technology of our art form, does the way people converse, the substance of what their conversations are about, has that really changed in centuries?
I'm talking with Wynton Marsalis, manager and artistic director at Jazz at Lincoln Center. Jazz used to be a vehicle for protest years and years ago, bebop and so forth. Is it still used in a social context at times today?
Yes, we're protesting. Every time we walk on the bandstand, we're protesting against the decline in quality, the use of negativity, the lack of musicianship, the walking away from integrity and excellence, the dependence on technology and things flash and substanceless things that are shiny, that take up and waste your time because they are exciting in very brief moments. So we are always protesting against those things that reduce. Now, sometimes in our case, we make records that say things like, I did Blood on the Fields about slavery from the plantation mm-hmm. to the penitentiary. I also dealt with like issues directly, protest issues. We do that, but our presence is a form of protest against all things that decrease our human potential and then dehumanize us.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that, I believe that you said jazz is a kind of democracy. Explain that.
Well, we have the rights to improvise and to make up what we have the right to choose what we want. Our forms are malleable, like our Constitution can be adjusted. It's constant checks and balances, like the bass is the softest instrument, the drum is the loudest. The two of them have to play on every beat and they have to negotiate each other. Mm-hmm. We have forms of dialogue and conversation, like riffs means the same thing repeated over and over again until either you get your point or you stop doing it. But we have a lot of responsibilities, like the responsibility of playing in balance, playing with your section leader, making intelligent decisions, being informed about the form and all the things that can help you to make a better decision about the flow of the music. So we're mutually creating, but we have the responsibility to understand what it is that we're creating as we make it. Whereas,
and each of you is a cell in that body of music, and you each have to play your role. That's
right.
A cell.
Sometimes you lead, yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you lead, and sometimes you follow, and you have to know because that can shift very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other forms of music, maybe a part is written out, and you just play it. The composer is taking care of that. Or you have a vamp, which is just kind of a beat or something that just goes on forever, and you play your part, and then that song is over, and they go to the next song. Our music is very dynamic, has a lot of shifts in it, and it's very much about interpersonal relationships and communication, not just between us on the bandstand, but also between us and our audience.
Well, you're a virtuoso in both jazz and classical music. And I'm curious, do you feel differently when you play jazz versus classical music? Does it come from a different place in your psyche when you play jazz versus classical?
Yes, ma'am. It's a different way of playing. It's a different form of music. In classical music, the music is written out, so you're trying to enact it and breathe life into it and come up with ways to interpret what's there. And jazz, you don't know what people are playing, and you don't know what you're going to play. You're improvising, and it's like a difference between reading a play or something that you have to act and bring life to and speaking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With such a strong New Orleans jazz heritage, I'm also curious as to what attracted you to classical music.
Mainly because of growing up with my father, and he was not prejudiced against forms of music. He would say, check stuff out. And I met a guy on a streetcar in New Orleans, a college student, gave me a record of Maurice Andre's, great classical trumpet player, and he just gave it to me. He saw I had a trumpet case. He said, you a trumpet player? I said, yeah, man. He said, man, check this record out. I went home. I was reading the liner notes, and it said that Maurice Andre's parents were coal miners. I thought, man, somebody's parents was coal miners, and he ended up playing classical trumpet. I got to hear this.
Mm.
So I put it on, the Haydn Trumpet Concerto, and I started wondering, I wonder if I could play like this dude. So I started to learn it off the record, because then we just learned everything off of recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to research about him and the music, and then I've heard there was a concerto competition for New Orleans Philharmonic to play Haydn Trumpet Concerto. It was the same piece that this guy, that Maurice Andre had played. So I entered it, and I won. I didn't think I was going to win, but I did.
And this year, about 13 or 14, right?
I think the competition, it was held when I was 13, and I played when I was 14. It was held when I was 14, I played when I was 15. Some kind of way, it was in those mm-hmm. years. And but then I started to become a fan of the music. I listened to Beethoven's music. I joined the Civic Orchestra. A friend of mine called me. It was on a Monday night. I remember because Monday Night Football was on. And he said, man, come down here with this orchestra. I'm the only brother down here. We're playing this classical music. I said, man, my Monday Night Football is coming on, man. He said, no, man, come down here. It was in the Jewish Community Center, which was next to a high school that I was attending. I was attending De La Salle High School. I went down there, and the newscaster was playing timpani. I said, man, this has got to be sad if the newscast is playing, the weatherman is playing timpani. But then I looked at, you know, all the adults there playing. I thought, wow, you know, it's interesting. All these people come here and sit in this room and play classical music. It was an interesting civic thing. And I sat down with him, and we were playing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. We were mutilating it. I mean, it didn't resemble Beethoven's Fifth so much. But just the way that, the earnest way that people were trying to play it, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I started to take in what it was about Beethoven. He wrote this music, then it's this. And then I went home. I started getting books on Beethoven. I started researching them. I read this book, Thayer's Life of Beethoven. And I went on from there, just really getting into the music.
Well, that's wonderful. That's what you have to do. Just kind of spread yourself a little further and check out the stuff that you just never thought of before. Learning is such a key thing, especially I think in jazz. And one of the things that, one of the programs that I really, really, really love is Jazz for Young People. It is really my favorite of all of your programs. I have learned so much from this program, and I know it's geared to, what, fourth to ninth graders, but just listening to your lectures and explaining what things are, movements, this and the interplay of that, it's absolutely fascinating. I've learned, like I said, I've just learned so much. You seem to have a special kinship with young people and for teaching them. Shades of your father, I guess. Would you say that education is a vital part of jazz?
Yeah, I think education is a vital part of life. And I mean, we all try to educate our kids. We take them with us. We want them to see things. We want them to be a certain way, even if it's just teaching them manners, how to say thank you.
Right.
And yeah, most of my stuff I got from my father, just watching him, his dedication. Very much I follow in his footsteps and try to do the same things I saw him do and the things he strived to do. He was always about teaching and about the community, and he always taught us kind of from the deepest part of himself, because he was a true believer in quality. And believe me, this was in a time when absolutely no one was interested in what he was teaching. So it was like just to see him teach with that type of intensity with almost a zero level of interest. Right. That was a great education for me for years. So it wasn't just that he did it for a few years. He did it all through the 60s, all through the 70s when I lived at home. I saw him, and I saw the way he approached that long, slow uphill battle. And I think for me, that's why I'm prepared to be out here and stay on this field till the day I die, is watching him. I don't really get tired. I don't get discouraged.
Yeah, well, I wondered how you do it all. I mean, you're doing so much, the books and the lecturing and the performing and so forth. And even back with Hurricane Katrina, you were so involved in that, helping to raise over $3 million. Tell me, did that event, that Hurricane Katrina, impact any of your music in particular or in any way?
I don't know that it didn't impact my music per se. I mean, I'm always serious about music. And I think also it's a lot of us working on stuff all the time. A lot of people all over the world came together to help New Orleans. It was a great feeling about it. Of course, it's tragic what happened. And for all of us from New Orleans, it left a kind of mark on our soul a certain way. It was something that, you know, was what it was and still continues to be that. But I think having an opportunity to work at Jazz at Lincoln Center and work in larger and larger fields with more and more people has taught me how hard everybody is working. And, you know, normally you would have a band, it'd be you and four or five other musicians, and that would be your world of people you work with. With us, we have hundreds of people that we work with. And if you include everybody around the world and all different presenters and promoters we interface with and their teams, it's thousands. You know, we all are trying to do work. And those of us who do kind of social work for nonprofit organizations, we all are trying to use our time and energy to uplift the quality of life and the consciousness of the people that we serve.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was just talking about the young people who seem to be pulled more and more into jazz through your efforts, and I appreciate that. My daughter, who's a jazz performer, had an opportunity to perform with your Ellington competition. You're a big fan of Duke Ellington. Did you ever get to meet him and know him personally?
No, ma'am. I didn't meet him.
Oh.
The one time I could have heard his band play, they came and played the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival in 1970. After my dad asked me if I wanted to go, and I didn't. I said, no, man. I'm going to play street football or something. So I always say, I always tell people that means don't ask your kids if they want to go to stuff. Make them
go. You just
go.
Take them, right.
Take them. We're
That's
here.
That's right. Who's in the audience today? Who's in the jazz audience? Have you noticed a change over the past, let's say, decade or so in terms of who's coming to jazz concerts?
I haven't noticed. It's mainly kind of a over 50s crowd, almost exclusively white American. In the United States, very few black Americans have ever supported the music. Dizzy told me of since the 1950s, he didn't really see a lot of our people.
That's surprising. I mean, because most of it, didn't it come from, you know, the black soul, the African spirit?
Afro-American spirit and consciousness produced the music. But the support of the art form did not come from that same spirit and consciousness. It's an American enterprise. It's unfortunate because I really think there's a lot in the music that could lead black people, really lead us out of this kind of cultural quagmire that we're in. Like when we look around, if we could just get distance and see what we actually are doing, I think we would.
What do you mean by that? Distance to see what we're actually doing.
You know how sometimes you gain a lot of weight and you don't notice it, and you see a picture of yourself 10 years earlier or something. You say, man, I gained 50 pounds or I gained When you sink down lower and lower into something, you don't, the day-to-day make keep, prevents you from learning. Mm-hmm. Or if you really talk abusive to somebody and there's a tape of it, and they say, listen to yourself talking. You say, wow, is that me? You can get distance and you can see it objectively. Mm-hmm. Or if you pass in front of a mirror at a certain angle, you don't get a chance to fix yourself right, and you can see yourself and say,
right.
I need to. I mean, we just have sunk down into such vulgarity and ignorance, and we are on a level so much lower than what our history has promised us that it's actually mind-boggling. I mean, and I'm from so deep in the community, I really laugh. I mean, I have to just laugh. It's so painful, you have to laugh at it. But when, you know, when people who are not from our culture look at us as a people and what we put out, the type of trash we're putting out there, we are like an international embarrassment, and we need to wake up. What it will take, I really don't know what it is, but I'm telling you, if we, I'm just hoping something happens that we kind of collectively can see what we look like. Mm. And we have other problems that are not just a cultural problem, you know, the whole kind of jobs problem.
Right.
The issues of slavery still have not been resolved, and there's a national debt that still needs to be paid. I'm not talking about reparations or, you know, any technical thing like that, but to think that all those millions of people are just going to be all right some kind of way, that is not working out. And that's another issue. But from a cultural standpoint, there has to be some element of choice in you deciding on calling yourself and words we used every day growing up. It's not like it's some new word that they invented. They've been around forever. But that a group of people settle on that as their principal expression, that's new in the world. And it's something that even a funkster like me from the 70s, no way we could have known. You'd have told me in 1976, one day we're going to be doing this and making these kind of videos. I'd have said, man, that'll never happen because sisters are not ever going to stand for it.
Well,
but here
right.
we are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not only are they standing for it, they love it, they embrace it, they defend it. And it's really indefensible and it's ridiculous. And it was ridiculous when I was 25 and 26 when it first came out. I knew it was ridiculous. I spoke out about it a lot. Now so, I'm 52 and it's like, you know,
so
but
do,
I never give up.
I was just going to ask, how do we get the pendulum to swing back?
I don't really know what it's going to take, but something will happen. I don't think you can any longer create dissatisfaction by attacking it. You could have did that a little bit in the beginning, but mm-hmm. it's going to have to be a mass kind of cultural. I always feel like the healing of the United States will not be from one group. It'll just
Absolutely.
Be a general holistic mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. that I don't care what color I am. I don't want to hear these people call themselves an mm-hmm. I don't want to hear them call these people period. Like it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I don't care if somebody says it's a cultural expression. I don't want just the same incessant ignorant beat over and over again with nothing going on top of it. I think it'll just be a mass kind of rejection of it. I think that in the way that people rejected slavery at a certain point as a concept, well, you know, it's owning people just is too much against our concept of ourselves. So if we have to kill each other for that not to happen, that's what we're going to do. And we'll reach that point where we're no longer going to find that a viable cultural direction as a mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we do create it.
Yeah, I hope I'm alive when it happens. That's my one thing. I hope the Lord lets me live long
yes.
enough to see that pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of, we aren't really speaking of swing, but I did want, before you go, to you briefly speak just a moment about the spirit of swing, 125 years of jazz at Lincoln Center. It was a book recently published last year.
Right.
But just kind of tell us a little bit about that briefly.
Well, it's 25 years of us. I wish it was 125. And it just tells the tale of our organization through 12 chapters, where we come from, what our objectives are, what it took to get us to this point, and where we will be going in the future. It's filled with fantastic Frank Stewart photographs. He's been our staff photographer the entire time. And testimonials from many people who've been a part of our institution. And it's designed to be uplifting when you read it,
mm-hmm.
for you to feel good about what a group of people decided to do in New York amongst all the other things that are taking place and that have taken place.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, as I was listening to you talk a little bit earlier before you answered that question, do you think in today's climate it's any easier or harder or more difficult for a young musician to succeed?
It's always uphill.
Always uphill.
Like, you have to prove that you want to be out here. There are very few spots. There's a lot of misinformation. And you have to go through all the misinformation. Are you one of the few who can understand that you've been misinformed and miseducated? Can you survive the kind of bad education and misinformation? Can you survive accreditation that doesn't mean anything? Can you survive your group and the desire and need to be popular? Can you survive philosophically the prevalence of just kind of reductive philosophies? Can you maintain your integrity and your hopefulness and optimism when you're surrounded by darkness? Can you struggle through not selling the type of tickets or not getting the type of audience response you want? Can you deal with your social life and maybe your girlfriend or your husband or your boyfriend or whoever it is not at all interested in the type of music you choose to play but likes things that everybody else likes? Can you survive critical ignorance and the type of attack that you will come under? Can you find other musicians to play with who are of equal mind and are willing to sacrifice to reach the level of excellence that you have to achieve to garner an audience in this type of difficult climate? Can you survive the backlash that comes from presenting an opinion, the truth as you perceive it, if it is not what the status quo everyday thinking is? Can you survive not selling records? Can you survive? Can you continue to develop and grow on your instrument in obscurity? Can you recruit people to the cause of playing the music? Can you? It's a bunch of can yous. They don't stop. And they are very for real.
Yes. Yes. I want to thank you so much, Wynton, for sharing this time with us. As a lover of jazz and, as I mentioned, the mother of a jazz artist, I really appreciate your contributions to its preservation and to its ability to bring people together. Thank you, Wynton. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much. My love to your daughter. Keep swinging.
All right. Thank you. I'll tell her. Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzis and Dave Baraswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Thanks for listening. Good night.